This is kind of amazing to speak in this format, sandwiched between my own two greatest mentors. It's really, I was just kind of a little bit overcome for a second there, realizing that I had this chance to be with you all and to be sandwiched between these two guys. So hopefully you remember what started and remember what ended, and then I just get blurred in, but my name stays on the sheet. But what I, you know, for Jim talking about how the street medicine movement got started and what street medicine is all about, I'm going to drill it down a little bit for you and talk about the how and the why. So what are the challenges that we're trying to overcome with this street medicine model? Why do we need a novel approach to the care of this very challenging, high-utilizing, costly, disenfranchised, suffering population? And we're going to go walk through that a little bit. But one of the themes that you're going to see come up is that we learned early on we need to work from a primary care model. And so one of the funnest things that we do in street medicine is that we get to literally work outside the box. We're not so burdened by the bells and whistles of the hospital system, but rather get to back to that moral core, that fundamental human relationship, that bearing witness to suffering, that thinking creatively, that makes this a lot of fun. So literally and metaphorically, we're outside the box. I have no disclosures, although if any of you know of any disclosures I might acquire, we could talk. The Street Medicine Institute needs you. So we're going to walk through here in this presentation a little bit about why folks who are sleeping outside suffer disproportionate morbidity and mortality, present to you very quickly some of the underpinning data. How are mainstream healthcare systems failing to meet the obvious need that the population presents, and whether or not the street medicine model might be part of the solution to that. A few important concepts just to familiarize you with. One is that homelessness exists on a spectrum. We talk primarily here about folks who are living on the streets, that is outside of shelter. But we also understand that those folks move rather transiently across the spectrum of homelessness, and that if we don't appreciate that that's the case and we silo our services to street and shelter and housing, that we by definition fragment the care. And we're trying hard not to do that. And we know that cohort is not particularly loyal to a provider, a clinic, a hospital. They do what they need to do. And we need to be flexible, nimble enough to respond to that. So keep this image in mind as we go through. The second concept is that most people who experience homelessness in our country do it for a relatively short period of time. But because they're homeless for a short period of time, they're not utilizing a lot of the system's resources. The group that we're going to focus on more and that most of this data is grounded in is the chronic street homeless population, the minority of homeless people that use up most of the resources. The third concept, that illness has an important role in three phases of homelessness. It can be part of the cause of homelessness, part of the maintenance of one's homelessness, and part of the complication of one's homelessness. You see here that major mental illness, substance abuse and addiction, and physical disability are three really important components of cause, maintenance, or complication. But the longer you stay homeless, the more morbidity you accrue. And in maintaining homelessness, we found that chronic medical problems are some of the most important in keeping people homeless. And then after you've been homeless a while, the complicating factors, the exposure-related injuries, traumatic brain injuries, physical and sexual violence, make it extraordinarily difficult to escape that cycle. This idea of the morbidity cycle, where poor health and homelessness feed each other with the accrual of insults, while you're homeless, trauma, shame, and despair are your best friends, unfortunately. Those beget poor health, and as your health worsens, your poverty, your disability, and your lack of access to adequate care also compound. So this cycle spins faster and faster and faster for a chronically homeless street person. So what's the outcome of that? This famous sort of underpinning study that has driven much of homeless health care policy in this country for the past 20 years by Stephen Wong and Jim O'Connell, looking at the Boston cohort, recorded 500-plus deaths in this group of folks seen over a five-year period, and calculated an average age of death among those folks, 47. So this is three decades earlier than life expectancy at that time. And we know that this is one of the highest mortality rates of any subpopulation in this country. Really alarming. Studies in many other cities have replicated similar numbers, with folks dying in their mid to late 40s on average who have been homeless on the street. So to try to get a better sense of, well, what is it that's driving that mortality risk? The sort of follow-up study looked at each of these deaths and paired them with a homeless individual alive at the end of the follow-up period, and noted not only were people dying young, but that the time of death relative to time of contact within that healthcare for the homeless program was really short. So can you imagine the pressure of that? If you're going to design a delivery model that impacts the problem of high mortality, but you don't have a lot of time to make a big difference, boy, you better strategize that one right, because you don't have a lot of trial and error to learn. Moreover, street medicine programs are the safety net. Who's going to care for these folks if the street medicine program can't care for them, if they don't forge the proper relationship, don't have the right resources, don't parlay the trust well enough? So from that study, we learned that, you know, some of the things that we stereotypically associate with homelessness or with your risk of dying, that is substance abuse, addiction, and mental health, are the most weakly associated with the risk of dying. The things that are strongly associated are problems that are we sort of think of as in the primary care rubric, that is the preventable or manageable chronic medical problems. We would say these are primary care problems. So what we learn is that chronically homeless people, they don't usually die from unique factors related to their homelessness. They die from what everybody else dies from, but they do it decades earlier. So using those epidemiologic risk factors, the Boston program established in the year 2000 this high-risk cohort. So if you met one or more of these high-risk criteria, you were put in a cohort and then tracked. I hope that you were at the session this morning where Jill Roncarati and Jim O'Connell presented the 12-year follow-up data from this cohort. But I want to show you the 5-year data in a second here, demonstrating to you this illness burden graph that most of the people in this cohort have major medical, major mental health, and major substance abuse and addiction problems, an extremely sick, complicated, medically, psychosocially complex population. This also underscores the idea that if you're going to make a meaningful intervention, that you better have specialists, interdisciplinary specialists from all of these that treat all of these problems working together at the same time, or have some rather miraculous clinicians, like many cities do, who do all three at the same time. Since this cohort is from Boston, we can't write off what happens to these people in terms of their morbidity, their mortality, and the cost to the system with this notion that, well, they're uninsured. So that's the issue. We just need to get people insurance access. No, not at all. Massachusetts is homeless healthcare Disneyland, right? Because we've had some brand of universal healthcare longer than anybody else in this country, courtesy of one of your presidential candidates who doesn't like to talk about that. And you can see that in this cohort, most people have health insurance. They had Medicaid or Medicare. So what happened to these folks at 5 years? And I use this 5-year number because we talk about 5-year mortality, 5-year survival rates for a lot of other medical problems. Well, here's the 5-year survival rate for chronic street homeless, for a high-risk chronic street homeless population. It's a third. I mean, anybody else know of a medical problem that strikes people in their early to mid-40s and kills a third of them after 5 years? I don't. It's an exceedingly, exceedingly morbid and mortal population. Again, showing to you the spread of the causes of death after 5 years, that many of these causes of death are preventable, manageable, chronic medical problems. So taking that cohort and looking what happens to them over a five-year period in terms of how much they utilize the healthcare system, and by the healthcare system, really talking about just three major urban Boston hospitals. This is shocking. 18,000 emergency room visits, that's 31 per person per year from that cohort. 871 hospitalizations. What is the cost of that? So just those emergency room visits, $13 million, or average cost of $22,000 per person per year, just in emergency room visits. To put that in some perspective and to help you understand why at the federal level funding streams have changed, the average fair market rent for a one-bedroom in Boston at that same time is $10,000. So it's not a far stretch to see this from the federal perspective and say, well, let's make an investment in housing, and maybe with the right wraparound services as part of a housing first model, we can make a dent in the utilization and cost problem. Okay, so this is just to set the stage for you all. Very sick population that dies very young, and while we're at it, spending way too much money. So big problem. The hospitalization problem is just as significant. On average, homeless people who are admitted to the hospital stay twice as long as their house peers and generate enormous excess cost. So if we have a model that's going to respond to this problem, not only should we be out on the streets and all the other places that people go, but the model ought to be able to follow them when they enter the hospital to work on safe discharge planning, reduction in unnecessary testing, enhancing relationships with care providers there. So here are our challenges based on that information. We're dealing with medical and psychosocial complexity. There's minimal preventative care or chronic disease management available through mainstream healthcare systems for the population. Medical problems are presenting in late stages or not at all. Sometimes these problems present with death, and that's the first time that we know that somebody from the street was sick, that they come in dead. That their chronic conditions are pretty difficult to treat without adequate housing or stability. And this is one of the most underappreciated factors in the way that in keeping people sick and enhancing their mortality are the recurrent negative encounters with mainstream medicine. One of the things we do that is sort of a pillar of street medicine, this idea of inReach that Jim mentioned. We're working inside the hospitals with those people on the front lines of caregiving, students, residents, staff, trying to sensitize them not only to the unique needs of the population, but humanizing the encounters. That when you show up and you lend credibility and say, Bob that you know as frequent flyer, hopeless drunk guy, we actually know as this loving, funny, interesting person, you know, who's had a whole bunch of bad crap happen to him and has these assets in his favor and has succeeded in recovery in these amount of times, suddenly the care perspective changes. And all of this leads to fragmented, ineffective, and unnecessarily costly health care. So how are we going to design the model to overcome that? Introduce this idea of homelessness on a spectrum and in sort of seamless transitions between these different kinds of homelessness. Well, street medicine starts primarily on the street, but if we were just on the street and said, well, what we'll do is we'll just do episodic care out here and then bridge people into the system in some way. Turns out that that's not enough, that street medicine team, who are usually interdisciplinary, medical health, behavioral health, case management, substance abuse and addictions, are working in all of these places. They translate to all of these places. So we follow the patients, not the institutions. This is a trend that's coming in medical education. You know, the new sort of Harvard model has medical students learning from a population of patients that they track wherever they go throughout the system instead of sitting there and letting people come to them. Because when people don't fit neatly through the keyhole that mainstream medicine has said you need to have to get care, things don't work out, and it's a recipe for fragmentation and discontinuity. So this model allows us to have our fingers in all of those pies as we track people throughout the system. And from the patient perspective, it's heartening to know that your caregivers, you can see those same faces, those same team members in all of these settings, shepherding your care and having some sense of the bigger picture. So all of these characteristics that we sort of have learned are critical to developing and maintaining a good primary care relationship. I think as you look at this list, you think, boy, I want my primary care to look like that. And that's part of the lesson that we have. We say, look, if we can work with this really, you know, this very small, narrow, complex, morbid, mortal population and have lessons about how to care for those people that ripples out into the rest of healthcare, the rest of primary care, we do a lot of teaching about what a primary care medical home actually looks like. I mean, these people don't even have homes, and we're still creating a medical home in that way. So it's, you know, one of our colleagues in London who just published a paper in BMJ about inpatient engagement with folks who are chronically street homeless. You know, he says that he sold that to his hospital, saying, you know, these folks, they're a stress test for your hospital. They show the gaps better than anybody else does. They show poor care. They show excess cost. And if you can learn from them, you take care of everybody better and do it more efficiently. So to illustrate all of this, I'll tell you one story. This is about Jim, not these Jims, different Jim. And Jim, if any of you are clinicians, you'll recognize this laundry list of complexity as very familiar for a chronically homeless person. We have the combination of serious medical problems, major mental health issues, and long-term substance abuse and addiction. And Jim, I can tell you, in those years that he was chronically homeless, especially on the street, incurred countless encounters with healthcare, many of them non-constructive. And during that time, he accumulated, in a one-year period, 25 ED visits, 8 inpatient admissions for a total of 108 hospital days. So one out of every 3 days in this given year, Jim was somewhere in the mainstream healthcare system. Back for a second to this concept of the morbidity cycle. So the longer Jim stays homeless and the more he utilizes, the faster the cycle spins, the harder it is to perturb. So how do you make a difference? Well, first of all, you have to slow down the cycle. You ever done this at the Science Museum experiment with the spinning wheel on the axis? You try to turn it, it's really hard because of the angular momentum of the wheel. But if you wait a while and slow it down and watch with the wheel, then it's easier to turn, right? So that's the concept here. Instead of becoming an agenda-driven force, we become companions in care, sort of the partners in health model. So what about respite care? This idea that, you know, Boston has done beautifully well and some other cities are getting into this intermediary care model between, you know, folks who are too sick for the streets and shelters but not quite sick enough for the hospital. Could that be part of the solution? How about housing? We talk about the housing first model, this upside down idea where the need is that people need to be sheltered. So let's give them shelter and then wrap around the services, rather than the traditional model of making people jump through a lot of hoops to qualify for housing. Recent studies from JAMA a couple years ago showing improved health outcomes and reduced costs for the housing first model as well. So how does that apply to this case, to Jim? Well, what I didn't tell you about that Jim's utilization pattern over the course of that year is that most of that utilization came in only 4 months. So during the first 4 months of the year when he was out on the streets, 94 hospital days. The next 8 months, in a combination of respite and housing, 14 hospital days. And neither respite nor housing would be possible for Jim unless he had a relationship with a street medicine team who shepherded him through all of these recurrent visits, earned his trust, was creative and flexible enough to work from his agenda instead of our own, and help Jim access respite and housing for success. And there's a picture of Jim there on the right shortly after the Red Sox won the World Series. This is his room in respite with his roommate, John. Unfortunately, Jim died shortly after entering housing, which shows us that housing is not the answer. It's just part, the beginning of the solution. But that's a sort of a good, you know, individual story of why the model can work for some people and how we can impact not only morbidity, but quality of life, cost, and all of these other associated features that we all would say, that's what we want our primary care to look like. So let me turn it over to Jim, who's going to talk a little more specifically about Boston as a case study for an effective street medicine practice.